Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Roughly 5 to 7 million Muslims live in the United States. It's a very small percentage of the population, but one that is attracting perhaps a disproportionate share of prejudicial hate, in part due to the publicity of the terrorist group ISIS and the political response by some. The slights are nuanced for some. Others have experienced public displays of verbal abuse, beatings, and vandalism. At a recent rally in South Carolina, Republican presidential primary candidate Donald Trump rallied his supporters to ban all Muslims from entering the U.S.
Somebody just needs to go in there and take control of this. I just think it's going rampant, and I'm worried about America, worried about our safety. They're getting in. They need to be stopped.
That was one of the supporters of Trump in South Carolina. Joining us in the studio is the director of Middle East Studies Center at Ohio State University, Dr. Alam Payind. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Also by phone is senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center, the editor-in-chief of its investigative magazine, Intelligence Report, Mark Potok. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how do we define Islamophobia today, Mark?
Well, I'm not sure I have a terrific definition for it, but it is irrational hatred and fear directed at Muslims. And we've seen a great deal of that. Really, it's been growing since 2014, and I think in large part initially due to some of the incredible atrocities from ISIS. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that has ratcheted up dramatically. Since early November, when Trump made his comments about national registration and banning of Muslims from this country and so on.
One critic of Trump's proposal said that Trump isn't really the problem, that he merely is indulging a sentiment that was already widespread.
Well, he's pandering to the worst instincts in portions of the American electorate. I don't think there's any question about that. Trump was essentially being overtaken by Cruz, at least in some places. Mm-hmm. And as we've seen throughout his campaign, you know, his response to that kind of electoral danger to himself is to attack. And in this case, you know, I mean, look, the reality is that political leaders ought to be out front. They ought not to pander to the worst in their bases, but instead lead people to a better place. And I think it's patently clear that Trump is doing quite the opposite.
The same critic that I referred to in the last question, Max Fisher, a writer for Vox, said that on a lesser scale, Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz had called for accepting refugees from Syria only if they're Christian, effectively banning Syrian refugees who are Muslim. But that didn't attract a fraction of the attention that Trump did, which suggests that the idea itself is somewhat normalized. Alam Payind, it's not new, and that normalization, does it surprise you?
No, xenophobia has been with the humanity for a very long period of time. We know that it's not a new phenomenon. Egyptians have implemented xenophobia against the Jews throughout the history, Babylonians, Assyrians, Romans against the Jews, and in the Middle East and in Europe later, in the medieval ages, it existed. The Islamist expansionist radicals have used that in the name of Islam. Crusaders have committed that in the name of Christianity. And we know the history and Inquisition against the Jews and the Muslims in Spain in 1490s. And then in your lifetime and my lifetime, because I was born at the end of World War II, Holocaust is a very nearest that kind of genocide which went there and Holocaust. And then even in the United States, the internment of the Japanese in World War II, the Ku Klux Klan against the Jews and the blacks in this country. And then again, it's not a new thing. The Iranian hostage crisis in the 1970s.
That's right.
So there was this backlash against the not only Iranians, all the Muslims. And then September the 11th has unleashed another one. But really the common sense prevailed that they did not blame the whole religion and the whole 1.2 billion Muslims in the world. So one thing that we have learned, that the consequences of this unfounded or unreal threat or fear against
Mark Potok put it,
yes,
irrational.
Yes, he said that irrational, yes, mm-hmm. against those. And I would go even further, that it's not only against or toward the hate toward Muslims. Uh-huh. It's even perceived fear. It's not only the real fear. It's the perceived fear against others and strangers. So the one thing that we have to mention that demagogues have always used this fear of the section of the public to their own advantage, and that has Hitler was one of those that we have a very clear example of that, and others have done Mussolini, and others have used it, and even during the Soviet period, the Soviet establishment, the Communist Party has used against others. Mm-hmm. So there are many examples that we can go on for a very long period of time.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the current trend of Islamophobia in the United States and really around the world. My guests, Mark Potok, he's senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center and editor-in-chief of its investigative magazine, Intelligence Report. And also with me, Alam Payind, he's director of the Middle East Studies Center at Ohio State University. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Mark Potok, we know there's an uptick, though, in hate crimes against Muslims in the United States. What do we know about that right now? Is that just something that occurred since 9/11, or is it something more recent?
Well, we know that in recent weeks and months, anecdotally, of course, there really are no statistics to prove that yet. However, I don't think there's the slightest bit of doubt. I mean, we've seen an enormous amount of hate and hate violence directed at Muslims and mosques in this country. I mean, you know, I guess the point I'd like to make is that what people like Donald Trump or the president or others in the public square say matters, has real consequences. An example of that is what happened directly after 9/11. Of course, that year, 2001, anti-Muslim hate crimes went up, according to the FBI statistics, by about 1,600%, which I think is totally unsurprising given what happened. What was surprising is that they fell off the next year, which began a mere 3.5 months later, in 2002, by 67%, by a full two-thirds. I think that's hard to explain, given the murder of some 3,000 Americans that day, other than to say what really did happen right after 9/11 was that President Bush repeatedly said publicly, Muslims are not our enemy, Arabs are not our enemy, our enemy is a very specific group, it's called Al-Qaeda. Bush also stood in places like the National Cathedral alongside imams and repeatedly made this point. The kind of inverse story about the relationship between words and hate or real violent consequences happened in 2010 when there were no jihadist attacks in this country or abroad of real significance, at least to Americans. And yet for the first time since 9/11, we saw hate crimes jump up against Muslims by 50%, again, according to the FBI. What did happen in 2010 was the so-called Victory Mosque controversy, ginned up by Pam Geller and other Islamophobes about an Islamic center that was to be built in Lower Manhattan. Many politicians joined in, people like Newt Gingrich saying, essentially comparing Muslims to Nazis. In addition to that very much publicized dispute, which spread to other mosques in the country, a man named David Yerushalmi published that year a report alleging, essentially, a conspiracy to impose Sharia law on the United States. And he also wrote model legislation, which has now been adopted by 8 states, making that illegal, which is absurd because it's not possible under the Constitution. In any case, what I'm arguing is that essentially those words, that kind of press in the mainstream is almost certainly what was behind that otherwise unexplainable jump in anti-Muslim hate crimes.
And even though President Obama, and pretty much every time he brings up the topic, says pretty much the same thing, that this is not about Muslims in general. This is about a very specific group. It's different now because we're in the middle of an election cycle for the next president.
That's right. And Trump et al. Simply suck all the oxygen out of the room.
Yeah.
You know, I think Bush's, Obama's State of the Union address was watched by very few people and hardly caused a stir. All the attention was paid to Trump. And, of course, it's absolutely true that many others in the Republican presidential field have made pretty similar comments. You know, it's not quite as outrageous as what Trump has said. But, you know, it comes down to the same principle. We're going to choose which Syrian refugees to admit based on their religious affiliation. I mean, you know, that comes from, you know, one of the so-called moderates, Jeb Bush, in the field.
Mm-hmm. Alam Payind, we're more aware of this now. We have places like the Southern Poverty Law Center that watch these sorts of things, but our human nature doesn't seem to change. Was there anybody fighting against it maybe in medieval times and in more long ago, or is this something that's evolved pretty recently, this rationalism about it?
We have examples in ancient period. The Jews were in diaspora after the Babylonian exile. And there was Cyrus the Great was against that. So he let the Jews return back and build their temple and even commissioned. And so we have historical examples of good deeds too. The important thing is that the worst kind of xenophobia is that when lumping together a very large group of people together, that it just by some radicals that who commit some sorts of suicidal attacks somewhere else, like September the 11th is one of the examples. It was not that all Muslims supported that. The worst kind of atrocities by Al-Qaeda, for example, that which started in the 1980s after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, was the Khobar Tower in the 1990s, are the two embassies in Darul Salam and Nairobi. So the Muslims were the first victims of Al-Qaeda. And right now, ISIL is not regarded as the representatives of the Muslims. And they have killed more Muslims. A vast majority of Muslims have been killed by the Islamic State or ISIL. And then there are reasons that why these two Al-Qaeda came to being. It was after the Soviet invasion. And Iraq did not have Al-Qaeda or ISI at the beginning, the Islamic State of Iraq. Then later, the Syrian atrocities by Bashar al-Assad and also the wrong policies of Nouri al-Maliki in Iraq antagonized the Sunnis. And so that's what, and the debatification policy was a wrong policy, which most of the military officers and others which were fired in Iraq, they joined the ISIL. So there are, we do not talk about these root causes of how these organizations were created, what really gave them the momentum. And there are 57 Muslim majority countries in the world. None of this governmental support is for the ISIL or Daesh or Al-Qaeda. So the governments are opposing those. People are opposed to those. And there were demonstrations in different countries that not in my religion's name, either Al-Qaeda or ISIL. So they are not the representatives of the 1.3 or 1.4 billion Muslims. So this is lost in the general public discussions in Western European countries and even in the United States.
Mark Potok, before I let you go, it wasn't one of the most violent things, I suppose, overtly violent, but that caught my eye was the incident in Texas. The two women were at a cafe. I think it was in Austin. I'm not sure. I can't remember right now. But they were verbally abused by some other people in the cafe, and everyone else just sat there and watched silently while it happened. That really that gave me a different feeling about what's going on right now versus anonymous vandalism and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's sort of like the Germans in in the 30s,
right?
Looking the other way.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. I mean, look, not to spend the entire interview beating up on Donald Trump, but, you know, he went beyond even simply saying we need to keep, any member of this 1.4 billion group of people out of our country. To me, one of the most despicable things that he's done in recent weeks is the description of Muslims, dancing in the streets in New Jersey as the Twin Towers fell. A completely 100% discredited theory, discredited by media, by law enforcement, and yet the picture it paints of our fellow Muslim citizens in this country is a pretty evil one. I really do think that Trump et al. Are enabling the more thuggish elements in our population to engage in hate violence. And I don't have any doubt that this kind of ratcheting up of Islamophobia in the last weeks and months is going to translate, and already is translating, into violence. Mm-hmm. And of course, as you say, I mean, there are an enormous number of people who might, a few months ago, have had the get up and go to say something in that cafe in Austin, but didn't. And I think that's what we're seeing more and more. I mean, it's shocking to read some of the polls. One recent poll suggested that something like 60% of Republicans agree with Trump on the idea of banning an entire religious group, which, you know, I don't think repeat. It's been said many times, but I mean, you know, that is a core value of this country, which was started as an experiment essentially in religious freedom.
Mark Potok, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate your time today.
A real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Mark Potok, he's a senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center and editor-in-chief of its investigative magazine, Intelligence Report. We'll continue our conversation about the recent trend of Islamophobia in the United States. If you have a question or a comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can join the conversation by email at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The attacks in Paris, the killings of three Muslim students in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, the San Bernardino mass shootings by two radicalized Islamists have fueled anti-Muslim feelings in the U.S. According to the FBI, hate crimes related to race, ethnicity, religious beliefs, and sexual orientation have dropped across the board. That is, with the exception of crimes against Muslims. Still with us in the studio is the director of Middle East Studies Center at Ohio State University, Dr. Alam Payeen. And also joining us now by phone is the director of research for the Pluralism, Diversity, and Islamophobia Project at Georgetown University's Prince Awalid bin Talal Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding, Nathan Lean. Welcome to the show, Nathan.
Thank you for having me.
What's the history of Islam in America? How far back does it go?
Oh, it goes back quite a way. We deal with really two large movements of Muslim immigration. I guess you could call it immigration. The second movement, really, though the first one is, I think, more directly related to the slave trade. Mm-hmm. So there's a really long and rich history of Muslims coming to the United States, not certainly always under great circumstances. But their presence here has been, I think, increasingly studied over time. And, you know, it's I think, in the context of discussions about Islamophobia that Americans really tend to kind of focus on the American Muslim population, their contributions, their demographics, and that kind of thing.
What do we know about its contribution, that demographic contribution to the United States?
Oh, all sorts of things. I mean, you know, I think the general view tends to be that Muslims are somehow different from Americans. But, you know, I mean, they're anywhere between 3 and 7 million, depending mm-hmm. on who you ask, Muslims living in the United States, Muslim Americans. We know that they're, for instance, the most racially diverse group in the United States. We know that, according to Gallup polling, 82% say that they're satisfied with the way that things are going in their lives, although I think more than half have said in the past that post 9/11 things have become more difficult for them. 40% of Muslims report having college degrees, which makes them the second most highly educated religious group in the country after Jews. And that is compared with 29% of Americans overall who say that they have a college degree. And this is, again, according to Gallup. So they are a very well-educated group, and they tend to hold all sorts of jobs. They're doctors, lawyers, bankers, school teachers, just as one might suspect of any other religious group or racial group. You know, related to education, though, I think that it's important to note, because this pushes back a little bit against common stereotype, that education really carries across gender lines, too, within the Muslim community. Muslim women are the second most educated religious group in the country after Jewish women. And so, you know, in conversations as we've been having over the course of the past several weeks about Islam and its place in the United States, you know, one of the common narratives that's advanced is that Muslim women are somehow oppressed, that they don't have the rights and privileges that their male counterparts have. And certainly there are examples of that being true in various places around the world, but in the United States, I would say that it's categorically false.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You just heard from Nathan Laney, Director of Research for the Pluralism, Diversity, and Islamophobia Project at Georgetown University's Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding. Also with us in the studio, Alam Payind. He's Director of Middle East Studies Center at Ohio State University. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You said anywhere from 6 to 7 million Muslims in the United States, Nathan Lean, that's still just about 1% of the population. That's really negligible, all things being equal, but there's perception that's different than that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And just to offer a point of correction, I think it's between 3 and 7, not 6 and 7.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Sure. I mean, and, you know, of course, it depends on who you ask. And one of the unfortunate things is it's very hard to know specifically, you know, about people's religious affiliation here in the United States through because, you know, we can't collect that information, at least through the federal government. But, you know, the polling data shows that it's generally between 3 and 7 when people are asked. But, yeah, they are a very significant it is a significant minority group. Not necessarily in terms of numbers, but just sort of in terms of how often we tend to focus on this one group, despite the fact that they are very small compared to the rest of the population. Yet so much of our public discourse politically and culturally, especially in light of things like, you know, attacks carried out by ISIS, the Syrian refugee crisis, bombastic election season rhetoric from politicians like Donald Trump and Ben Carson, you know, our focus tends to be directed at this very small group. You're absolutely right.
But that focus really has only emerged since when? I mean, is it not? It's not just since 9/11, but all things being equal, for most of the time, there hasn't been much focus at all.
I think that's right. I wouldn't necessarily pin it on 9/11.
Yeah.
But I would say that 9/11 certainly exacerbated it. More reasonably, I think if we look backwards in time, 20 or 30 years before that, to the time of the Iranian Revolution in 1979. And perhaps we could even go back a few years earlier to the oil crisis, the nationalization of the Iranian oil market, and America's sort of increased focus on the Middle East and Muslim majority populations abroad as strategically interesting, right? That they could offer the United States something in terms of land access, in terms of oil, in terms of all sorts of things. And so, you know, when the government began to direct its attention at the Middle East back in, you know, the 1970s, what we see is that, you know, following that throughout the 1980s into the 1990s and certainly well into the 2000s, that attention became more pronounced. The military's footprint there became more entrenched, and as a result, we're now talking about Islam and Muslims in ways that perhaps we wouldn't be otherwise.
Carl in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Carl.
Good morning. Dr. Payind was at Mershon right after the 9/11 attacks, so I have heard him speak before. Why is it that the media presumes that Islamophobia is unjust? Don't they know the difference between a piñata and a Trojan horse? It's the only religion that I'm aware of that was founded by a militarist. I'm told that the Medinans, city of Medina, chased Muhammad out, and he came back with an army. So there is a history of military violence by the Prophet that could support modern violence in a way that the other religions do not. For instance, Gautama Buddha was a total pacifist. Jesus Christ was a pacifist. But Muhammad took a sword and went down and conquered Medina. So calling it Islamophobia is, about as justified as being afraid of spiders. How about you, Anne? Are you afraid of Trojan horses? And by the way, one final point here. The war god Mars had two sons. Phobos was only one of them.
Okay. Nathan Lean?
Well, I think it's absolutely hysterical to hear something like that, especially a statement that would suggest that other religions, and especially Abrahamic religions, monotheistic religions, don't have a history of violence. I mean, you know, I don't think that I need to bring up the example of the Crusades, but that's certainly one, I think, that points to the violent history in the Christian tradition. And, you know, I mean, it is the case that I think most people, you know, discuss Jesus in peaceful terms, but we can cherry pick there too and point at the example of him going into the temple and overthrowing tables in a fit of rage at the tax collectors. Or we can say, you know, that the verse in Matthew where he says, you know, we can point to the verse in Matthew where he says, "Think not that I've come to spread peace. I've come not to spread peace, but the sword." If we go through our various religious traditions and cherry pick, we can find that there are violent passages, violent narratives, violent histories, and all of them. But that's not the point. I think, you know, more critically, we need to look at the context in which these things arose, the history, and understand really the difference between cherry-picking various elements of our theology and looking at the normative experiences of Christians, of Muslims, of Jews, of Buddhists around the world, and to see how is it that they interpret their faith, how is it that they live their faith out. And when we look at the religion of Islam, it is absolutely the case that the violent individuals are the minority. They're a fraction, a very small fraction of a very large religious group, 1.6 billion with a B people. So there's absolutely really no reason to think that Islam is any more violent than other religions. It's just, I think, the case that in light of groups like ISIS, in light of what I mentioned a moment ago, which is America and European strategic interests in the Middle East, we happen to be talking about the religion of Islam and its adherents more frequently than we might have had those things not, you know, had we not been in the situation that we're in.
Dr. Payen?
Yes. When we go to the history, let's take the question of the Prophet Muhammad going from Mecca to Medina. Mm-hmm. He was persecuted in Mecca by his own relatives, Quraysh. So the people of the Medina invited him. So that's when, historically, that's not true that he went by sword. Then, later when he came back to Mecca, so Islam really did conquer a very large areas. They used the sword. There is no question about that. No one can deny that. But when you look at the Christianity, when Emperor Constantine became a Christian, and he said he had a vision, he saw a cross. In the name of the cross, he conquered, and really, he conquered many, many places. Then we go to the Crusades is another one. When the Crusaders started in Europe, they really slaughtered the Jews in the Rhine Valley first, then the Orthodox churches in other places. Then they went to Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, there were Christians and Jews, Muslims and Jews, and they really, the Crusaders have killed literally thousands of them. And the Inquisition is another. So other religions have done exactly the same, but maybe different. The Hindu fundamentalism is a very strong. So Buddhism is a different. It's a pacifist religion. There are pacifist religions. But these are the three Abrahamic religions. The Hebrews, for example, when they went back to capture the areas which were promised to them, and then Saul and David and Solomon, they did conquer other places too. So the followers of different religions have done it, and Muslims have done it too. So no one can deny that, yeah.
Omar and Lewis Center, you're on the air. Hi, Omar.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say a couple of comments here, if you don't mind. One is that Islamophobia, really, although it's not something new, it really definitely intensified after 9/11. But what makes, I think, Islamophobia interesting in the United States is the fact that it really established itself as an industry, which means that a lot of people really became very rich. And the hate that the really espoused definitely is spreading. And the, you know, the Daniel Pipes and the Frank Gaffney and the Bridget Gabriel and Emerson, all those people really made a bundle of money on a false premise. And what bothers me the most as a Muslim living in this country for more than 30 years is that when I came to the U.S., really it wasn't a little bit, it wasn't like this. It really became absolutely worse after 9/11, but after 9/11, in the beginning it was bad Muslims there, but suddenly Islam became the focus. And Islamophobia made Islam as the center, like Islam is bad. And thus, Muslims are worse than other people.
I think that's an interesting distinction, Omar. Nathan Lean, can you talk about that? It does seem like we as a country or people are more focused on the religion itself and anyone who subscribes to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Omar makes some really interesting points.
Yeah.
I mean, the first thing that he said was that Islamophobia is not new, and that's true. I mean, we know that the word Islamophobia goes back to 1910. When it was first used by French writers to describe the experiences of West Africans under colonialism. So sustained negative views of Islam and Muslims is not something that just came about after 9/11. It's not something that really even just came about after the Iranian Revolution. It's been around. It's been sort of well primed for a long time. But the second point I think that he made about the groups that are behind Islamophobia, some of the money, I think speaks to why we tend to focus on Islam as opposed to Muslim. These are individuals like, I think he cited the example of Frank Gaffney. Frank Gaffney was the guy that was behind Donald Trump's, the poll that Donald Trump cited when he suggested that we ban Muslim immigrants to the United States.
Okay.
I mean, his group gets an enormous amount of money, millions and millions of dollars a year from various donors that are tied to special interests. That believe that Islam should be represented in an expressly negative way. And, of course, all of this is also tied to the fact that, unlike other prejudices in our country's past, Islamophobia is unique because it is tied to the security state. I mean, it is tied to America's interests and presence in Muslim-majority countries. And so groups like Frank Gaffney's Center for Security Policy, which advocate sort of hardline policies towards these countries, I think have a reason to toe this line that Islam, a religion, is expressly violent. It goes beyond Frank Gaffney. There are a slew of other people that we could discuss, like Robert Spencer, Pamela Geller, many of the most prominent anti-Muslim voices in our society.
So that explains why psychologically we grapple with religions differently. We see that as an outside religion versus, say, Baptists or Catholics who raised to oppose abortion rights in the United States. They firebomb an abortion clinic. It's different. We see it differently.
Well, yes, it's different because there are interests that are tied up into promoting it differently, and there's a lot of money behind it. I mean, exactly as you say, we make distinctions when it comes to other religions. You know, we don't look at Colorado Springs and say, well, the guy that shot into the Planned Parenthood building or whatever and killed these people, you know, he is representative of Christianity. Most people would laugh at that. They would say, absolutely not. This guy's an aberration. This guy is an extremist, and we can separate his views from the views of Christians. But when it comes to Muslims, partly because they're new, I guess newer than Christians and Jews in the country, but I think partly because they are tied to the topic of Islam is tied to these ideological special interests. A lot of money is pumped into the veins of people that promote these narratives, and so here we are unable to really distinguish Muslims from their, extremist Muslims from their religion more generally.
We'll continue our conversation about Islamophobia when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Donald Trump's proposal to ban all new immigrants and refugees who identify as Muslim has been denounced across the United States and within his own party. But for many Muslim Americans, the damage has been done, at least for now. We're talking about the trends in anti-Islamic sentiment in the United States. Still with us in the studio is the director of Middle East Studies Center at Ohio State University, Dr. Alam Payind. And by phone, the director of research for Georgetown University's Bridge Initiative and author of The Islamophobia Industry. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Alam Payind, you and I were talking off the air. You said, you know, you do have a personal experience that led to part of what a lot of your outside speaking involves.
Yes, I go in, give speeches, outreach activities in synagogues and churches. I've been doing this for the past 30 years.
Right.
But one of the experiences, we journalists, whether journalists or scholars, it's not fashionable to bring some personal experiences. Mm-hmm. I would probably like to share it here today.
Please do.
September the 11th, when it happened, my daughter was a senior in one of the Columbus high schools. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be a very good school. On the day, so one of the social studies teacher mentioned to the students on that day that we should go and nuclear bomb all Muslim countries and expel every single Muslim in the United States. So he just said it. Mm-hmm. It was a sad story, and this guy got emotional.
Right.
And my daughter rose there and said, well, I was born in the United States. My parents have come from Afghanistan after the Soviet invasion. They escaped discrimination and violence. They came to the United States, and my father came here as a PhD. He did not come here as an economic employee. Do you want me to leave the country? So this professor this teacher apologized. So one day in one of our staff meetings, I just mentioned this to my colleagues at the Ohio State University.
Uh-huh.
And believe me, everyone, single person was against that. And then one of the professors at the Ohio State University, he was a Jewish, and he shared this story with his associates, the Tiferet Israel.
The synagogue.
Uh-huh. Yes. So the synagogue invited me, and I mentioned this story there too. So believe me, I said the same thing in one of the mosques, but the Muslims were not that much that we should press charges against this teacher. But the Tiferet Israel, because for Jews, this was a very recent history, the Holocaust. They said this teacher does not belong in that kind of school system.
Because that's the start.
Yes, because for them, this was a fresh wound. Muslims have not experienced Holocaust, for example, in any one of those. But for Jews, this was really a fresh wound. So this is one of the personal stories. And then again, I was a foreign student advisor at Indiana University when the hostage crisis happened.
In 1979, right.
Yes. So one of the fraternity boys went and threw stones in one of the married student housing, which was Saudi Arabians.
Mm-hmm.
So as a foreign student advisor, I went to...
They were Saudi Arabians.
Yes, they were
Saudi Arabians. So they were confused to begin
with. Yes.
Yeah.
So they considered that was a Muslim and probably Arab, Iranian.
Yeah.
So I went there as one of the foreign student advisors, and I wanted to calm down the situation.
Yeah.
And I said, well, look, first of all, this is wrong. These guys have done nothing, even if it's an Iranian. But he's a Saudi Arabian student. Why do you do that? And one of the kids screamed from the group that is, well, it's close enough. So I said, he's a Saudi Arabian, he's not an Iranian. So these are some of the personal experiences that when the situation is bad, when Americans are killed, 3,000 Americans, September the 11th, and now all these terrorist acts in different cities, especially in California. So it's an emotional time, but I think that the politicians, journalists, and scholars and professors should be very careful what they are saying, because there are people that who are in a stage to do things which probably they will not do under the normal circumstances.
Nathan Lean, when I hear the story about the kids, and I was at Arizona State University, I was a student there when the hostage crisis occurred in Iran, and my experience was people felt sorry for Iranians who were in the United States because a lot of them were being pulled back. They were kind of people without a country. They didn't know where to go or what to do. But there was a lot of animosity toward them at the time. But also there was a lot of ignorance about what exactly a Muslim is.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think that's an excellent point. One of the differences, though, I think, between those experiences and likely the experiences of many Muslims today is that Islamophobia has really come of age at a time where, unlike other prejudices, the internet is the public's primary source of information. I mean, look, we all do it. We break out our iPhones or our Androids and Google things. We mm-hmm. check our Twitter pages or our Facebook pages, and it's also social media that is a central part of our lives, and it allows narratives to be transmitted to wider audiences very, very quickly. And so I think that there's a real consequence there. I mean, this can be a cesspool of bad information where stereotypes, spin outward into social media. They influence the way that, for instance, students view their peers, colleagues view their colleagues. And so it creates an environment where it's very difficult to distinguish good information from bad information. But it also creates an environment where people, I think, feel empowered that they read something on the internet that, a relative sent to them, or they see something going out on social media or Facebook, and that to them is good enough. They don't have to verify it. They don't have to fact check it. They have this statistic, that they've cherry picked. They have this verse from the Quran as the, sort of indicative of the caller earlier who referenced, violence in the Islamic tradition. They cherry picked this bad example or that bad example, give it a certain spin, and that is, in a sense, their ammunition for going after their Muslim colleagues or classmates or neighbors or whatever.
Pete in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Pete.
Yes, I just wanted to add one point, that this religion of Islam is huge. There are over a billion of them, and you can break them down into three basic types. I would say liberal, they smoke cigarettes, drink a beer. The conservative, no cigarettes, no beer, don't even look at a lady. Mm-hmm. And radical. Now, this third group is the group that we are all concerned with, and we must be very careful not to lump them all together. That's the problem. And I'll just take the rest of the comment off the air.
All right, Pete. Thank you so much. Alan Payeen?
He's right that Muslims are not monolithic, just like Christians are mm-hmm. not, Jews are not, Hindus are not, Buddhists. There are different kind of Muslims. They usually say that there are Sunni Shia. Sunnis have persecuted the Shiites for a very long period of time. And the Shiites in the 16th and 17th century, especially in the Safavid Iran, they persecuted and forcefully converted the Sunnis into Shia, that sort of thing. These have happened. Mm-hmm. And again, there are people like the one who committed this atrocities in September the 11th, the Al-Qaeda. These are the radical groups that which are not appreciated within the Muslim world. The Muslim, as I mentioned, that there are 57 Muslim majority countries. None of them, these ISIL or Daesh or Al-Nusra or Khorasan or whatever these groups are, or Hamas, they do not have a universal support among the Muslims. There are people that who are supporting. There is no question. Just like among our candidates, there are some that who support whatever the candidate is saying, and there are groups. And the same is true among the Muslim societies. But the Muslim establishments, the Al-Azhar University is the center of the Sunni Muslims scholarship and jurisprudence. They have condemned September the 11th, all these terrorist acts, and they are condemning ISIL. And there is the Shia center of their scholarship and jurisprudence, which is in Qom, Iran. Iran is diametrically opposed to what ISIL and Daesh and Al-Qaeda is doing. So there are Sunni radical groups and there are Shia radical groups. They're all rejected by the majority of the Muslims.
You know, Nathan Lean, given what Alan Payeen just said, why is it that there's this narrative that the Muslim community worldwide doesn't condemn what ISIL, what ISIS is doing?
Well, because I think that that's what so many people want to believe. But all one has to do is Google, do Muslims condemn terrorism or Muslims condemning terrorism? And they will be inundated with example after example after example, thousands and thousands of Muslim groups from Morocco to Bahrain, from Malaysia to India, from, you know, Iran to Saudi Arabia to Pakistan, even, you know, more countries that we kind of tend to think of as more, you know, extreme in their interpretation of religion, condemning groups like ISIS, condemning terrorist groups like al-Qaeda. So there is this sort of comfort, I think, that a lot of people have in just believing what it is that they've always believed, because maybe they hear it on the news or they hear it on social media, and so they don't want to take the initiative to look for good information. But taking that step and saying, you know, I tend to believe that Muslims don't condemn terrorism, or I heard it on, you know, Fox News, or I read it in an email that was forwarded to me by my crazy uncle, so I'm just going to believe that. One should take, I think, the next step and see whether or not that's true. I want to make a quick point, though, about the, if I might, about the caller that just phoned in and asked the question, or
Pete, yeah,
different the three different Muslim groups.
Yeah.
I think that there's a real danger with that way of thinking. I appreciate the idea that there is diversity within the Muslim population worldwide, because there certainly is, and I think that that might have been what he's getting at. But I want us to proceed with extreme caution when we sort of go about carving up the Muslim population arbitrarily into two or three or four categories. There are liberals, there are conservatives, there are extremists, and suggesting that, you know, there are Muslim groups around the world that fit very neatly into any one of those categories. I think that's incorrect. I think that it's probably more of a spectrum, that there's diversity even within those types of groups. But what this tends to do when we suggest that there are these, you know, groups, there are conservative Muslims, there are extremist Muslims, there are liberal Muslims, is it tends to create a situation where we favor one group, where we favor the liberal Muslims who, as the caller said, smoke and drink and go out to the nightclubs and that kind of thing, and tend to view the others, the conservative Muslims or the, you know, certainly the extremist Muslims, unfavorably. You know, of course, it's right to view the extremists unfavorably, but what we don't want to do is kind of slip into this place where religious conservatism then becomes a vehicle for extremism. Because I think that, you know, we certainly wouldn't look at a figure like Mike Huckabee or a figure like, you know, Jerry Falwell Jr., both of whom have said really horrible things about Muslims, and suppose that because they are conservative Christians, that would necessarily place them behind the weapon of a group like the Lord's Resistance Army. You know, we tend to kind of make distinctions in the Christian tradition that we don't want to necessarily make when it comes to diversity of the Muslim faith.
And also the idea that it's a stepping stone process, that if the closer you are, that somehow being a conservative religious person of any stripe puts you closer to the radical.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Precisely. This is what is referred to commonly as the conveyor belt theory, and it's categorically false. It's been widely debunked in academia and by various think tanks, but it's precisely that. You know, the idea that the Muslim who goes to the prayer on Friday, that the Muslim who uses Islamic religious expressions like subhanAllah or mashaAllah or things like this in their daily vocabulary, the Muslim man who wears the jalaba, the Muslim woman who wears the hijab, that these are indicators of someone on a path to extremism. They're absolutely not.
Sure. Alan Payne?
Yes, the professor is absolutely right. I grew up in a family of that my maternal and paternal side. We had this religious scholars. We had this a group of people that who went to universities and got their PhDs and engineering degrees and others. So one had this, the religious establishment, the spiritual part of the, both of them were against extremism. So in some cases, we should not lump them together either, that it's a conservative. Yeah, part of my relatives are very conservative Muslims, but they did not like this extremism or other what did ISIL or Daesh or Al-Qaeda or Taliban are doing. So they were opposed to the both sides. We're opposed to this kind of extremism.
I want to thank you, Alan Payeen, for joining us again. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much.
Alan Payeen, he's director of Middle East Studies Center at Ohio State University, and also Nathan Lean. Thanks to you, Nathan.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Nathan Lean, he's director of research at Georgetown University's Bridge Initiative and author of The Islamophobia Industry. Thanks to the All-Side staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Shyla Knott, All-Side's interns Trent Lammers, Ryan McFadden, and Sydney Schaefer, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Renee Montaigne. Reporting to work at midnight here at NPR West has some upsides and downsides. I mean, I'm often here with David Green, who has a very cheery morning personality, which, by the way, David, I'm not sure if that's an upside or a downside.
Let's call it an upside, okay?
Okay, we'll call it an upside. We'll add it to the plus side of getting to help you start your day. And now you can help us start our day when you donate your old car. We'll turn it into Morning Edition. Here's how.
Visit WOSU.org/cars. And support comes from Global Gifts, providing holiday gift ideas while paying artisans a fair wage. Featuring handcrafted jewelry, accessories, toys, and home goods from more than 40 countries. Located in the Short North at 682 North High Street. More at globalgiftsft.com.
This is WOSU-FM and HD1 Columbus, 89.7 NPR News. Global, local.
IBM, a corporation once synonymous with the computer age, has fallen out of the limelight. Like many other big tech companies, IBM managers are looking to artificial intelligence to return the company to the forefront. Coming up on Tech Tuesday, the past and future innovations of IBM, and also how Google is using neural networks to create psychedelic art and develop understanding of how those networks operate. That's Tech Tuesday, after the news on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News and online at WOSU.org.